Welcome to the Arlington Street Church podcast. Founded in 1729, Arlington Street continues today as a gathering place for progressive people of faith in the greater Boston area and beyond. We are located at the corner of Arlington and Boylston Streets, across from the Public Garden in Boston, Massachusetts. Please visit ascboston.org for more information about this historic Unitarian Universalist congregation. Arlington Street Church, gathered in love and service for justice and peace.
Our first reading this morning is from retired Unitarian Universalist minister, Reverend Victoria Safford, who served congregations in Northampton, Massachusetts, and White Bear Lake, Minnesota. It's called Memory. I once taught at a farm school in Vermont, where it was the custom on our Memorial Day to visit all the little cemeteries in the countryside nearby. There were many of these, some in churchyards or next to open fields where churches used to be, some on windy hillsides, some hidden far back in the woods, overgrown with brush and brambles, dimly defined in shadows by the remnants of a low stone wall. These expeditions were led by the teacher at the school, a native of the town who remembered where all of these forgotten places were. Children and teachers together piled into several cars and went to maybe 5 or 6 graveyards in a day. At the entrance to each one, the teacher had us join hands in rows of two rows of 10 or 12, and then slowly walk the grounds, looking out for the graves of veterans, many marked by little metal signposts, but some so old that we had to bend and squint and read the wind-smoothed stones. They dated to the Revolutionary War and the War of 1812, the Civil War, the 2 World Wars, and the Korean War. There were a few more recent monuments to men who died in Vietnam. All of these were interspersed, at peace again, with all of the town's civilians. It was a very solemn kind of game. On finding the grave of a veteran, someone would call out, "Here's one, here's one!" And we'd clear the leaves and branches off, replace last year's little faded American flag with a fresh one, and then read out the name and dates. Before leaving each cemetery, we'd gather in a circle, and some child would play taps on the recorder. And some would read a verse from Flanders Fields. And then we'd stand in silence, the loud silence of bird song and spring wind, till the teacher would say quietly, so quietly you could barely hear him, "Let us not forget." And we move on down the road. The youngest children with us on those days were remembering things they had not yet learned, names of people dead in wars they'd never heard of, vast sadnesses their minds could not yet imagine. But even they could grasp it. We were honoring these fallen dead so that someday there would be no more. Together, 2 dozen souls of mixed age and experience were remembering the future. It was a prayer, though none was spoken. Here ends the reading.
If you have been to the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C.,
you've witnessed the way architect Maya Lin's design for the monument put shiny black granite in a wide V formation, engraved with the names of the soldiers who fought and died in Vietnam. The reflective quality of the granite makes it almost like a mirror. You cannot read the names without seeing your own reflection in the stone. The author of this poem, Yusuf Kamaniyaka, served 1 tour of duty in South Vietnam in the mid-1960s, facing it. "My black face fades, hiding inside the black granite. I said I wouldn't. Damn it, no tears. I'm stone, I'm flesh. My clouded reflection eyes me like a bird of prey. The profile of night slant against the morning. I turn this way, the stone lets me go. I turn that way, I'm inside the Vietnam Veterans Memorial again, depending on the light to make a difference. I go down the 58,267 names, half expecting to find my own in letters like smoke. I touch the name Andrew Johnson. I see the booby trap's white flash. Names shimmer on a woman's blouse, but when she walks away, the names stay on the wall. Brushstrokes flash, a redbird's wings cutting across my stare. The sky, a plane in the sky. A white vet's image floats closer to me. Then his pale eyes look through mine. I'm a window. He's lost his right arm. Inside the stone, in the black mirror, a woman's trying to erase names. No, she's brushing a boy's hair.
If I could, I would place a $100 billion bounty on the hate that makes the wars, that digs the graves at Catoosa County. As peace lovers, we religious liberals often sit a little uncomfortably with the idea of Memorial Day, especially as the holiday has been culturally lifted up as an opportunity for strident nationalism. Seas of American flags on lawns of town centers, parades and solemn speeches with scouts lined up in their uniforms and the singing of the national anthem. Red, white, and blue ads for barbecue grills and mattresses and clothing at new, low, low prices somehow continue our American tradition of linking freedom and consumerism. And yet, like many things in American history, it bears another look, especially in its origins. Yale historian David Blight reminds us of the long-lost history of the first Memorial Day, or Dedication Day, as the Civil War ended. He writes, "In the spring of 1865, after a long siege and prolonged bombardment, the beautiful port city of Charleston, South Carolina, lay in ruin, occupied by Union troops. Among the first soldiers to enter and march up Meeting Street singing liberation songs was the 21st United States Colored Infantry, their commander accepting the city's official surrender. White people had largely abandoned the city, but thousands of black folks, mostly formerly enslaved people, had remained. And they conducted a series of commemorations to declare their sense of the meaning of the war. The largest of those events took place on May 1st, 1865. During the final year of the war, the Confederates had converted the city's Washington Racecourse and Jockey Club into an outdoor prison. Union captives were kept in horrible conditions in the interior of the track. At least 257 of them died of disease and were hastily buried in a mass grave behind the grandstand. After the Confederate evacuation of Charleston, black workmen went to the site, reburied the Union dead properly, and built a high fence around the cemetery. They whitewashed the fence and built an archway over an entrance on which they inscribed the words, "Martyrs of the Race Course." I'm pretty sure the pun was intended. In cooperation with white missionaries and teachers, they staged a parade of 10,000 people on the track. The procession was led by 3,000 black school children carrying armloads of roses and singing the Union marching song, "John Brown's Body." Several hundred black women followed with baskets of flowers, wreaths, and crosses. Then came black men marching in cadence, followed by contingents of Union infantrymen. Within the cemetery enclosure, a black children's choir sang, "We'll rally round the flag and the Star-Spangled Banner." and they sang spirituals before a series of black ministers read from the Bible. The war was over, and Memorial Day had been founded by African Americans in a ritual of remembrance and consecration. The war, they had boldly announced, had been about the triumph of their emancipation over a slaveholder's republic. They were themselves the true patriots. Just a few years later, on May 5, 1868, General John Logan issued a proclamation that Dedication Day be observed nationwide after communities everywhere had celebrated their own war dead in different ways. And soon, those localized observances glorified the position of whatever side their community was on in the war, continuing the stridency of battle and righteousness, even as they honored their dead. The Union celebrations, of course, lifted up the righteousness of preserving the Union and ending enslavement. The Confederate celebrations lifted up the cause of independence and preserving heritage. The Black history of honoring the war dead, though, was erased from memory. Maybe it shouldn't be surprising that we politicize our war dead in the same way that we make meaning of the war itself. Journalist and former war correspondent Chris Hedges points out in his book, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. War makes the world understandable, a black and white tableau of them and us. It suspends thought, especially self-critical thought. All bow before the supreme effort. We become one. We become one. Most of us willingly accept war as long as we can fold it into a belief system that paints the ensuing suffering as necessary for some higher good. Because human beings seek not only happiness, but also meaning. And tragically, war is sometimes the most powerful way in human society that we achieve meaning. At this moment in our national story, when we live in anxious dread of so many things, raids by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, assaults on gender nonconforming folks, the loss of every social safety net for the most vulnerable among us, in this moment, it's critical that we hold the full heartbreak of the human cost of war and consider how we might shape a new story before it's too late. On Memorial Day, we acknowledge the power of death, the power we humans have to make ourselves a sacrifice, and it matters greatly what meaning we draw from it. Even as we mourn the dead we know, our own ancestors, there are billions of people in the world we don't know who mourn those who fought on different sides in battles we haven't even heard of. And that is only counting armed conflict, not to mention the wars of neglect or outright hatred with real consequence, the unimpeded flow of illegal drugs that have wrecked huge swaths of our nation, the denial and cowardice that led to so many thousands dying of AIDS, the continued slaughter of innocents by our own law enforcement and by the availability of weapons. Now that all those numbered are dead, what's the best way to honor their legacy? To love our neighbor, to live according to the commands of the power of the love we lift up every week. My prayer for us this morning, friends, is that we might find ways to remember ourselves into a future that holds at its core a deep reverence for life, born of the love that sustains us all and does give this life its meaning. What, we might ask ourselves, is the standard we want to set for that love that can and will build true freedom in our world? One of the best things we have as an asset in congregations like this one is that we exist across many generations, collecting names and stories, wisdom and sorrow. And it's here that we get the chance to feel ourselves woven into history, part of a lineage that includes experiences so very different from our own. Instead of just reading them in history books or documentaries, we can listen to the full account of a neighbor among us. Only here do we have the opportunity to meet folks who aren't our family members, might not be our age, our education level, or professional colleagues, and get to know them well. Chris Hedges, as his antidote to the meaning found in war, writes, "To survive as a human being is only possible through love. And when death is ascendant, the instinct has to be to reach out to those we love, to see in them all the divinity, pity, and pathos of being human, and to recognize love in the lives of others, even those with whom we are in conflict, love that is like our own. It doesn't mean we avoid war or death. It doesn't mean that we, as distinct individuals, will all survive. But love, in its mystery, has a greater power. It alone gives us meaning. It alone allows us to embrace and cherish life. Love has both the power to resist in our nature that which we know we must resist, and to affirm what we know we must affirm. And love, as the poets remind us, is eternal." Friends, may our religious value of love guide us into rightful remembrance of those whose lives have been lost to wars through all times and places, from all faiths and races and nationalities. And let that remembrance be our clarion call to rise to the demands of human fellowship, diplomacy, and generosity. Let peace begin with us. And with every breath we take, let us make the solemn vow to live according to the laws of love that help us see beyond the limitations of our own imaginations and demand justice for ourselves and for all people. Amen. And we go forth knowing the commitment that we have to holding the love in our hearts, to breaking down barriers between us and them, to seeing everyone as part of us, as part of creation. Help us to live this commitment in each small act we can control, and to fight collectively to affect those things beyond our individual control. Let the light of the lives we have lost burn brightly in our hearts that we might change the world, remembering a different future. May this love stay with us until we meet again. The service begins when the service ends, my friends. Amen.
Where you go, I will go, beloved. Where you go, I will go. Where you go, I will go, beloved. Where you go, I will go. For your people are my people. Your people are mine. Your people are my people. Your divine, my divine. I will go, beloved. Where you go, I will go. Where you go, I will go, beloved. Where you go, I will go. For your people are my people. Your people are mine. Your people are my people. Your divine, my divine.
Please visit ascboston.org for more information about this historic Unitarian Universalist congregation. Arlington Street Church, gathered in love and service for justice and peace.